little something between you and me. Don't cost you nothing, this one's for free.
Would we all agree the right thing to do at the beginning is to invite the patient to tell us a story? And I do think, people obsess a bit about this, but it's quite interesting. In most parts of the country, there's no really easy way to start this. What can I do for you? Keith, what have you come to as your opening offer?
I prefer nothing.
Yeah.
But I accept that in the setting of the CAS exam, they kind of have to have something. So how can I help you today, mate?
Yeah. I mean, in the CSA, it doesn't really matter because the actors are trained to respond to anything, aren't they? And as long as you make some sort of sensible bit. I think the CSA should be done in Yorkshire, though, because they've got this easiest in Yorkshire, because in Yorkshire, you just have to say, now then. And that's perfect, because it's an utterly meaningless, it's a totally non-directional prompt, and which is sort of what we're trying. This is where you can even do that noise, it's silence, but with a, with some sort of over to you type gesturing, isn't it? And patient, you've probably already found some patients are telling the stories that walk through the door. They subvert all this, which, it's quite time efficient. Yeah, quite good work, really. Bursting with a narrative. And I know that those people who are about to face or have recently done the CSA, you will be better than older doctors at letting the patient finish, complete those opening remarks. It'll have been drilled into you in this health centre. That's what you should do. And you should, the evidence is clear. So none of that should change. There's no... don't do anything different there. So the key moment, when you think about it, in the consultation, the first point at which time management starts to go awry is when the doctor first opens their mouth after that. All right? This is a critical moment. And if you want to collect the agenda, if you want to screen and make sure that all the agenda items for today are mentioned first before you devote time to them, you have to seize this moment. And a problem is if a patient's anxious and told you a story and you say, right, is there something else? They may feel inadequately acknowledged in relation to the original narrative. Mm-hmm. So what's required is a dose of acknowledgement, sufficient for them to think, right, the doctor's got that. And if you then say, we'll come back to it in a second, but can I just check? Things are almost always okay. Does that make sense? You're nodding, aren't you? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Might that have helped, do you think? Yeah, that's interesting. I'm still trying to think how prems have worked, but it's likely to, there will have been a narrative, and if you acknowledge the narrative and bridged into it, that would have created a moment. Yours obviously sounds like a complex agenda setting process, which might be quite interesting to work to, prem. Now, the other thing, of course, is in line with the business meeting, I think it's only, to be fair to the patient, they've only got 10 minutes, and for me to say, well, you're here, I want to do 6 quaff things, is a bit unfair, isn't it? So if we are proposing to colonise their 10 minutes with a clinician-generated agenda item, we should tell them up front as well and let them say whether they find that happy, whether they're happy with that or not. And now we may have more than we can deal with today, which is which point to deploy the... educate the patient. That sounds a bit ambitious for the 9.5 minutes that's now available. So there's another thing, if I go back into practice as well as my chairs, I shall have a little screen just behind me, a little TV screen, and I shall have a video of John McEnroe's rant available. Do you know the one where he said, you cannot be serious, man? And if, if the agenda's too long, I'll be... I call it the McEnroe moment. So that's a comment. I haven't got any glib answers for that, but that's something that it might be quite interesting to explore, exactly how to sort of sell the, wow, that looks really important, so important, in fact, you're lucky, I'm going to give you 2 appointments for that one. It's, somehow turning it into a positive message.
So that fits in neatly with Prem's suggestion of saying, well, we're not going to be able to deal with all of that in one single consultation. It sounds like that one's urgent, so we can deal with it at the end of the surgery today, or we could see you tomorrow in one of the urgent slots and negotiate from there. Yeah.
To be truthful, after that I had asked the patient to book in double appointments until we get to the bottom of things.
Yeah.
Good.
Yes. No, quite so, with a complex patient. Please.
I went on a course recently about CSA preparation.
Yeah.
And they were addressing the whole issue of focus and structure and getting through things quickly. And one of the things that was kind of almost a little bit new to me was when we were talking about agenda setting, my understanding was that it was just sort of thinking about how many problems there are, what things I need to deal with, like quaff stuff, and the timing. But a kind of an interesting thing that they added to it was that in the first sort of 19 seconds when the patient's opening and telling their story, that you should be looking at them and based on their age and gender, be kind of thinking in your mind what are the most likely diagnoses. So if it's an elderly man with a headache or if it's a young woman with a headache, you're kind of setting out your differentials, thinking about red flags and planning what the next 10 minutes of your consultation is going to be like and thinking, I need to do this, I need to ask these focus questions to rule this out, I need to be doing this. I mean, that sounds amazing, but I think I still struggle with...
I think it's bad advice.
Coming up with all of that in sort of 20 seconds.
No, I think it's bad advice, let me tell you why.
Right.
I've got the wrong set of slides.
So like back pain in extremes of age is going to be much more risky than back pain as a 30-year-old. So if a 90-year-old walks in with a new back pain, you'd be more like, oof.
Yeah, I guess just starting the thought process.
Well, the problem is, if you're doing too much thinking, is you don't listen properly.
Yeah.
And especially at the beginning, what you should be doing is listening to the patient and noticing all... Now, for the CSA, it might be quite good advice because you've got a technical challenge. You know, it's an artificial situation. You've got a technical challenge and that's it. But in the real world, it's not good advice. You should trust yourself that that will come out.
Okay.
What you need to do at the beginning is pay absolute attention to the patient and not just what they're saying, but the way they're saying it.
Yeah.
Because it's rich with contextual information. And if you're too busy thinking what's the differential diagnosis here, you'll miss some of the subtle cues.
Yeah.
And those subtle cues, you know, the earlier you find information out in a consultation, the more it has the ability for you to deploy time effectively. You know, if something is only discovered at 9 minutes, it's quite hard to contain it. And the same thing, if you discover something big at 30 seconds, you've got a chance in 9.5 minutes to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So the earlier the better. So right at the beginning, what they say and how they say it is critical, and there's lots of subtle and contextual information in the opening narrative. And please go ahead. Yes, I mean, and speak up if I'm not looking.
Okay, yet. So you know, and you said you should be, you know, give them their 100%. Now, I have a tendency of just making points. For example, if they say I've got back pain for 3 months,
yes,
I feel I need to write 3 months because I forget.
No, I can cure that. You're welcome to make notes any other time, but not during the opening narrative. Okay. Because even making notes distracts you. So the what I'm about to suggest will be a help to you, okay? It is coming down to then what do you do? What do you do after the opening narrative? This is your first chance to speak, all right? And my suggestion is that what you should do is acknowledge what you've heard. And there are two elements to acknowledgement. One is to acknowledge the key details, and the second is to acknowledge the sort of emotional tone that you're detecting. And if you explicitly acknowledge those, then the patient feels very well attended to and is more likely to then agree to any chairing of the meeting suggestions you make because they'll know that you're on their case. Yeah? And the second thing is it helps the doctor because if you acknowledge the facts with a key summary, so the main issue, if I'm picking it up correctly, the main points are A, B, C, D, and E. That's right, doc. Then, if you want to say, I'll tell you what, that's quite important, let me just make a quick note, then you're all right. Yeah? If it's critical for you to do it at that point, but not before. So make your note after the patient has heard that you've got it. And of course, they might correct you. No, it's A, B, C, D, and F. Ah, great. Let's get that down. Yeah? Does that sort of sound like a doable suggestion?
Yeah.
Your patients like us to be thorough. They don't mind us making notes. It's just a question of timing. Anything you do that distracts from full attention during that opening narrative will reduce your effectiveness.
It's not just that you've heard what they've said, it's how they've said it. So how are you going to feed that back?
Yes, good point, Keith. Very good. Can I put the answer to that on hold for a second,
absolutely,
please? No, it's a good question, and it actually moved me on very nicely. I just wanted to bring one other bit of information to your attention, which you might be quite interested. This was a research study published in the BJGP, but done in Middlesbrough. Charles Cornford, did you ever meet Charles? I heard your name to tell him either.
No.
Okay, well, he was he did some research at the deanery and he's retired now, but he was single-handed at the time. And he recruited 150 patients who'd phoned up the reception desk to say, I'd like to see the doctor, you know, to book an appointment. 150 patients who answered the following two questions with a yes. Do you mind if we ask if you've got a new problem that you're planning to mention? Yeah, well, I am. Yes, I have. And the doctor's got a nurse doing some research. Would you be happy to speak to her for 5 minutes about your... I don't know how much information they were given, but about the study when you come to the surgery before your appointment. Yes, I would. So 150 consecutive... They kept going until they got 150. They just sort of started and stopped. That's not a truly random sample, but it's free of any recruitment bias, yeah? It's a convenient sample, they're known as in research terms, and they have certain statistical advantages. So And the research question was, when they came to the nurse, you know this problem you're about to see the doctor about, can you recall, before you picked up the phone this morning, because it was same-day appointments were possible, before you picked up the phone to book the appointment today, can you recall speaking with anyone in your social, well, they didn't use the word social network, but that's what they meant, in your social network, about whether or not you should go to the doctor with it? And it could be the patient had said, what do you think? Shall I go to the doctor with this? Or it could have been an unsolicited E when I get to the doctor with that, oh, Bill had that and he dropped dead. So it's called lay referral, by the way, that. Yeah. When a non-clinical person recommends someone else to go to the doctor, that's known as a lay referral in the social science literature. And the average number of conversations that were itemised was 3.6. Yeah, does that make sense to you? You practice quite near there, yeah?
Probably, yeah, I mean, cool. One of the things which I have been, they rehearse what they're going to tell the doctors when they're sitting in the waiting room,
yes,
as well,
yeah,
mentally. So,
okay, so, well, it's interesting, Joe. I mean, I thought the figure would be a bit lower than that when I saw the title. I was expecting it to be one or two. 3.6 makes sense, does it?
So that's the number of people they've spoken to.
Well, it could be one person 3.6 times, or 3.6 different people, or some conversation in two. It's 3.6 conversations with someone in their network. Yeah, it's not unimaginably large, is it? But it's a little larger than I personally imagined.
Many patients have told me, well, my brother asked me to go and see you. One of my relatives asked me to see you. So it keeps coming back.
It's usually one key person, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you ask that question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly the sorts of people were not surprised. Mm. Intended to be relatives, you know, married, you know, sort of partners or close family members.
With the technology going up nowadays, I think the internet plays a big role in these things as well. Many patients have said, like, well, I've gone on the internet, it told me about a few things, and hence I'm here.
Well, it would be quite interesting to repeat this in the modern day and factor in Google and NHS 111, wouldn't it, into the equation. And of course, some of these patients, you know, that's recalled conversation. So, some of the patients will have forgotten some conversations, so that's got to be a minimum estimate. And the thing that really surprised me, they recruited 150 and ended up interviewing 101, and only one of the 101 said they hadn't done it. 99% of these patients had at least one conversation. One had itemised 17, which is, imagine that. Oh, and I think I told my wife twice. It's quite a large number, isn't it? I suspect there's a diagnosis in there in itself.
Personality disorder.
Sorry?
Personality
disorder. Yes, or maybe OCD or something, yeah. So, we sort of know this. Patients have narratives and they've been quite well rehearsed. And as you say, Prem, then they may rehearse them internally in the waiting room. Generally, if I'm sort of sitting at the door waiting to go into an important meeting, I'm quite often playing in my head, how am I going to put this? And also, they might see their mate in the, well, I'm going to see that nice young doctor. I've heard she's lovely and I'm going to tell her all about my bunions. So they might actually rehearse it in the waiting room with one of their friends. So we can be fairly confident the opening narrative's, very well rehearsed. And I know you're, I'm sure that you're well versed in this, so I don't want to, I just thought you might be interested in that specific study. So the key thing is, what do we do next? And in terms of acknowledging patients, like I said, two elements, the one that we've got on hold, which is the next slide, and this one, acknowledging the factual element. Now, I don't want to be facetious about this, pardon me, this won't work for every situation, and possibly not for some of these more complex situations. This is Abraham Lincoln delivering the Gettysburg Address. And this is the government of the people, by the people, for the people speech, yeah? And three is a bit of a rhetorically magic number. That's why politicians do it a lot. Who can forget education, 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 yeah? And yes, we can. Obama's stump speech was a good one, wasn't it? And, I came, I saw, I conquered. It worked 2,000 years ago in Latin. So, now...
Save the NHS.
Oh, no, very good, yeah, very good. Yeah, location, location, location. I mean, it is, there's three. Two's not enough. And four is more than you need for maximum punchy impact. So four works. Well, the only thing I have to offer is blood, sweat, tears and something else, one of Churchill's speeches. So four does do it, but two's not enough. Three is the smallest number that has the kind of rhythm that really has a rhetorical impact. And so is the most frequently used rhetorical version is. Now, I mean, I'm certainly not suggesting that every clinical scenario can be effectively and adequately summarised with three bullet points, but an awful lot can. So your problem's a cough, it's been going on for about 4 weeks and it kept you awake for the last 2 nights. If you find three really important things that the patient's told you in the narrative, in a relatively, well, you know, straightforwardly delivered narrative, it forms a very good acknowledgement. In the more complex cases, you will need more than three. I'm not suggesting that you never use four in the rest of your life. But I don't know what percentage. Yeah, it feels like about 90% three works well. And then if you need more, then you'll know. If when you're doing the recap, it's four or five obviously fall into it, use them, you know, go for it. And that's sort of almost telling you that it's a more complex situation. It's just quite a useful checkpoint. Three is the magic number.
Let's hear it for our GP. Skills improving, risk removing, no confusion.